listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today we take a look at something that occurs every day at the United Nations in New York, and that generally escapes the attention of the American media. A press briefing by the spokesperson for the Secretary General, Stefan Dujarric, reviewing the work of the UN around the world and taking questions from the press. Among the topics discussed Thursday were countries from Afghanistan to Yemen and subjects that included border incidents, ceasefires, political affairs, natural disasters, and violence. This is the spokesperson for the Secretary General of the United Nations, Stefan Dujarric, in New York at the United Nations headquarters Thursday.
How's everybody today? Good? Excellent. All right. Good afternoon. The Secretary General will be traveling to Canada this Saturday, 9th of June, to attend the summit of the G7 in Charlevoix in Quebec. He will be participating in the outreach session of the G7, and that session is entitled Healthy, Productive, Resilient Oceans and Seas, Coasts and Communities. And he will be attending that session along with the leaders of the G7 and several other countries, as well as heads of international organizations. He will also hold a bilateral meeting with Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, on the sidelines of the meeting, as well as other heads of state and government also present at the G7. And the Secretary General will be back in New York that day and be back here the evening of the 7th. I have a senior personnel appointment. The Secretary General has announced the appointment of Shireen Dodson of the United States as the new United Nations Ombudsman. She will succeed John Barkat, to whom the Secretary General is grateful for his commitment and dedicated service to the organization. The Secretary General also wishes to extend his appreciations to James Lee, who is currently serving as the acting UN Ombudsman. Ms. Dotson brings to the position over 30 years of diverse leadership experience in business, government, and nonprofit organizations. She's currently the Ombudsman of the U.S. State Department, a position she assumed in 2010. And the Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, Rosemary DiCarlo, today visited Mogadishu in Somalia, where she held a series of meetings with senior government officials to reiterate the UN's support to the people and federal government of Somalia. She was accompanied by the Secretary General's Special Representative for that country, Michael Keating. Ms. DiCarlo said that Somalia is at a critical juncture and stressed that the unity of Somalis is essential to advance federalism, reduce violence, defeat extremism, and tackle the humanitarian challenges and deliver real benefits to the population. Also today, the UN and its partners, including the African Union and the European Union, welcomed the outcomes of this week's National Security Council meeting held in Baidoa, the capital of Southwest State in Somalia. During the meeting, the federal government the federal government, federal member states, and Benadir region and various ministries reached key agreements on the transition plan, revenue sharing, and the electoral model for the 2020 elections. And our humanitarian colleagues in the Central African Republic tell us that amid renewed fighting, at least 9 humanitarian compounds have been looted since May in the Central African Republic's second largest city of Bambari, prompting many NGOs to temporarily suspend or curtail assistance to an already struggling civilian population. Bambari has more than 37,000 internally displaced people living in 9 sites. They rely on humanitarian support for health care, nutritional support for children suffering from acute or severe malnutrition, food rations, and psychosocial support for survivors of gender-based violence. The resurgence of violence in Bambari comes at a time when the humanitarian community is making every level to raise the funding for the humanitarian response plan. In the first half of 2018, only $85.5 million, or 17%, of the $515 million urgently needed to help 1.9 million people in need has been received. And from Afghanistan, the UN mission in Afghanistan today welcomed the announcement by the government for a temporary ceasefire with the Taliban. The UN commends the stated preparedness of the Afghan authorities to initiate in good faith any steps towards formal peace process. And that was a statement from the Secretary General Special Representative Tadamichi Yamamoto. The ceasefire follows the Afghan government's call for unconditional peace talks with the Taliban at the Kabul Process 2 conference that was held in Afghan capital in February. And the special envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, just concluded consultations on the Syrian political process. Those discussions took place in Istanbul earlier today. And he also, while there, he met with Turkish authorities as well as officials from the Syrian National Coalition and the Syrian Opposition Coalition. The envoy is planning to continue his regional consultations in the coming days. And from the Congo, a couple of updates on Ebola. Distribution of World Food Program rations have begun in the DRC's Ebola-hit Equateur province. This is part of an effort to support those...
In this video, we will be discussing how to troubleshoot
signing... I can't turn the damn thing
on. Well, just... There we go.
Okay.
All right. In this video, we're going to learn about the World Food Program's ration distribution. Maybe you want to take the computer outside, Evelyn. Evelyn, maybe just take the computer out.
There are 3 megas.
I'm trying to turn the whole computer on.
Okay.
All right. Back to you.
Let's try it one more time. All right. Let's try it again. The World Food Program's rations have begun being distributed in Equateur province, which has been hard hit by Ebola. This is part of an effort to support those directly affected by the latest outbreak of the deadly virus and limit risky population movements. Families of Ebola patients discharged from treatment centers and of those who have had contact with them or suspected victims are receiving up to 3 months' supplies of cereal and beans. A projected 1,000 people are to be immediately assisted. And also on Ebola, the World Health Organization is supporting the 9 countries that border the Democratic Republic of the Congo to scale up their national emergency preparedness and response capacities. These countries are Angola, Burundi, the Central African Republic, the Republic of the Congo, Rwanda, South Sudan, Tanzania, Uganda, and Zambia. The World Health Organization's recommendations are meant to ensure that the countries are operationally ready to prevent the importation of cases, implement risk mitigation, detection, and response measures for Ebola. And our colleagues at the UN Migrants Agency, IOM, are assisting survivors from a boat that capsized off the coast of Yemen. At least 100 Ethiopian migrants were crammed into a boat that left from Somalia on Tuesday and was headed to the Gulf countries when it got hit with a high wave. IOM says that 46 people drowned and 16 remain missing. IOM is providing medical assistance, health, food, and psychosocial support for the survivors. And an update on Guatemala, where colleagues from the humanitarian coordination team have assessed the needs in shelters near the south center city of Escuintla, the most affected area by the massive eruption of El Fuego. The team is assisting the government in the humanitarian response, providing psychosocial support, hygiene kits, mattresses, and blankets, among other provisions. And a couple of answered a couple of questions I was asked offline, one on the Ukraine. And the Secretary General's response to the PRST adopted yesterday. And I can say the Secretary General welcomes yesterday's presidential statement adopted in the Security Council on the situation in eastern Ukraine. He fully shares the concerns expressed by the Security Council about the deterioration of the security situation in eastern Ukraine and the need to do more to alleviate the suffering of the civilian population. This needs to be all the more important and urgent, as highlighted by the recent shelling of Donetsk filter station, which has been rendered temporarily inoperative. The Secretary General reiterates the determination of the UN to continue with all the efforts to address deteriorating humanitarian situation in Ukraine, in eastern Ukraine, and urges greater humanitarian access to support the humanitarian response plan of 2018, which remains severely underfunded. The Secretary General also joins the Security Council's call to all parties to commit to the peace process and to do their utmost to achieve progress in the implementation of the Minsk Agreement. And I was also asked earlier about Ethiopia's stated decision to implement the Algiers Peace Agreement. And I can say that the Secretary General was pleased to hear the statement by the Executive Committee of the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, indicating Ethiopia's decision to implement the Algiers Peace Agreement signed between the two countries in 2000, and the subsequent decisions by the Eritrea-Ethiopia Boundary Commission on the border between the two countries. We reiterate the UN's readiness to play a role in taking the decision forward, including by assisting the parties in the implementation of the border ruling as envisaged in the peace agreement. We look forward to receiving additional information on the way forward. Our monthly food price index report. Global agricultural food commodities prices rose in May, with dairy prices jumping significantly. That's according to the FAO's price index, which is up 1.2% from April. The increase built on a recent trend featuring rising price quotations of major cereals and dairy products and weak ones for sugar and vegetable oils. The FAO has increased its forecast for the world cereal production for 2018. More information online. And our friends at UNICEF today launched a new parenting site as part of their Super Dads campaign, recognizing fathers' role in their children's early development. The online site will bring together fathers from across the world to share their parenting tips, their struggles, their needs, and their successes. UNICEF is calling for more support for fathers globally, including for policies that give parents the time and resources needed to spend quality time with their children. And as Father's Day celebrated across nearly 90 countries this month, UNICEF renews its call to break down cultural, financial barriers preventing fathers from spending quality time with young children. And today we have reached the temperature of 103 because Nauru has joined the honor roll, having paid its dues in full. And I will stop there. Yes.
Thank you, Stefan. I want to ask about the water crisis in Iraq. Turkey started holding back water on the Tigris River causing further water shortage in Iraq, as nearly 70% of Iraq's need of water is coming from Tigris and Euphrates, those two rivers, which are coming from Turkey. What is the U.S. position about
this? Sure, we're very much aware of the communications between the government of Turkey and Iraq regarding the new Ilusu Dam that Turkey is building on the Tigris River. The UN office in Iraq hopes that the government of Iraq and Turkey can resolve the matter through dialogue.
Thank you.
Mr. Roth.
The 103 temperature reading is sometimes what it's like in our offices here in the summer. But moving on.
Take your tie off, Richard. You'll feel more comfortable.
I don't want to embarrass anyone. The UN envoy in Yemen, or for Yemen, Martin Griffiths, is making the rounds. We know he's coming to the council mid-month. Can you comment on a Reuters report that he has a so-called peace plan, which includes the Houthis giving up heavy ballistic missiles in return for an end to the Saudi bombing campaign with a transitional government agreement? Anything on the paper, on the table like this that you, I know it would be difficult for you to confirm in toto? Can you give us an outline of something?
In toto? I'll do
We're
it.
Not in Kansas, though, yes. So please, in this toto, is New York, you can be honest.
Yes.
With
okay,
you.
Sorry. No, we've seen the report. We're not going to comment on the veracity of a document that may or may not have been leaked. Mr. Griffiths has been making the rounds in Yemen and in the region in preparation for his presentation to the Security Council next week, I think on the 18th or the 19th. And I think at that time he will be ready to share where he thinks where he feels the situation is, but he is making great efforts in trying to get the parties to reach a political agreement to put an end to this conflict in Yemen, which has caused suffering for so many people in the country. Oleg, and then Matthew.
Thanks, Stefan. Staying on Yemen, I believe the meeting on Yemen is going to be in a week, so in the council. And I'm sure you've seen the reports from MSF that they're pulling stuff out of Yemen. I believe it's like more than 70 people. And this, they say it would have a crippling effect on the operations in Yemen. What is the UN right now doing in light of possible offensive?
I'm not aware of any changes in our staffing on the ground. As always, you know, our colleagues that operate in Yemen do so under very difficult circumstances. The security is analyzed on day to day, but I'm not aware of any changes. But obviously, any loss of humanitarian staff creates even greater challenges to the ones that already exist.
Taking into account the scale of the operation MSF is doing in Yemen, is the UN prepared to somehow substitute what
they're doing? I don't have the operational details of what MSF is doing in Yemen, but I don't think we're in a position to take over the work that our partners are doing on the ground. And you know, the vast majority of the work, of humanitarian work done in Yemen, is done in fact by Yemeni nationals. Yep.
Thank you, Stefan. I'd like to ask about this memorandum of understanding the UN has reached with the government of Myanmar. I was wondering if there is a timeline for this agreement to be implemented for the safe, dignified, and voluntary return of the Rohingya refugees. Thank you.
No, there is no. I'm not aware of any timeline. I think, as we said yesterday, the conditions don't exist for that return don't exist as of yet. You know, the agreement was negotiated with UNHCR, UNDP, and the government of Myanmar. Our colleagues in Myanmar are continuing to engage communities in designing the activities implemented under the agreement and provide independent information to refugees about the conditions on the ground in order to inform them to inform their return decision. Basically, the decision to return belongs to the individual. No one should be or can be forced to return. It's about us working with the government of Myanmar to ensure that the conditions for safe and dignified and voluntary return exist. But the assessment of those conditions at the end will have to be made by individuals. Yes, sir, and then Matthew. And then
bonjour, monsieur. Stéphane, this is Deepak Arora from the Tribune Online. There have been reports of a mysterious illness striking American diplomats in Guangzhou in southern China. And there have been also reports of Canadian and U.S. diplomats experiencing the similar sonic attacks in Cuba. So what has been the response of the Secretary General on this? And has he directed WHO to work on this mysterious...
I've seen the press reports. It is not something that we're involved in any way. Yes, ma'am.
Sure. I want to ask a follow-up on Yemen and something on UNHCR, or the Secretary General said otherwise. In terms of Yemen, just in terms of Martin Griffiths and his plans, it seems like The Norwegian Refugee Council has called on the Saudi-led coalition to investigate a bomb that fell right next to its facility in Sana'a on the 5th of June. And I'm just wondering, one, does the UN, is Mr. Griffiths or whoever here in the Secretariat is looking at this, are they satisfied with the way in which the Saudi-led coalition has investigated and acted on the falling of its bombs? And what's the status of the Children in Armed Conflict report, which would seem to, I know that last year they were upgraded in terms of their attempts to minimize civilian casualties, and it looks like NRC is saying these steps are not...
The report should be out soon. The report will be looking at the year of 2017, right? But it'll be sent to the council probably not next couple of weeks, not too long from now. We have been continuously concerned with the civilian death toll, the attacks on civilians, the attack on civilian infrastructure, and we have repeatedly called on the coalition and other parties to fully investigate those incidents. Your next question.
Sure. I wondered, yesterday you'd said, in terms of this settlement of retaliation claims by Ms. Hunt Mathis, you directed me to read their joint statement. Mm-hmm. So I've read it. But I also note that, and this is why I'm coming back to you with this, she's barred from speaking beyond this joint statement as a condition of her settlement. And I'm wondering, first, does the Secretary General think on issues having to do with alleged retaliation for wanting to investigate rape, is it appropriate to put a gag order on a UN person? And also, she did somehow manage, and I'm not sure it's published, so here's her quote beyond what they did jointly. She said, "The UN justice system needs to be placed entirely outside the purview of the UN, which cannot be at the same time party and judge." So that seems to be something on which the Secretary General should have a response. It's about the system as a whole.
The system of the administration of justice in the UN was reformed a few years ago. Its judges are independent. The Secretary General has no say in how the judges do their work. The administration represents itself in front of the tribunals, and staff do too. And sometimes rulings go against the administration. Sometimes they go for the administration.
What about this gag order issue?
I'm not going to comment on the specifics of the case, of which I'm not aware. Evelyn, and then Linda, I think you had a question, then back to Oleg.
Yeah, Amnesty International had an item today on raids into villages in Mozambique by al-Shabaab, probably not related to Somalia. I just wondered if, and people, villagers killed quite frequently.
I wonder
if you had a report
on
that.
I've seen the Amnesty International report. It's something that's very much on our radar and something that we're very much concerned about, this violence. Linda.
Thank you, Steph. Regarding the Syrian political process, you mentioned that the UN envoy is in Istanbul, or was in Istanbul to meet with Syrian opposition leaders, and that there would be other meetings in the region. I was just wondering if you can share with us where else the meetings will be taking place. And with
As soon as we get updates from him, we'll share them with you. But he regularly travels around the region. But I'll see if I can get a bit more detail. Oleg, and then we'll come back.
On Syria, with this announcement on the consultations by the special envoy, does this mean we're coming closer to resumption of negotiations?
Look, I think we've been at this for quite some time. It's a process, I think, that's frustratingly slow, not least for the people of Syria. We're taking it step by step. Yeah, go ahead.
On Ukraine, given this lack of funders, this was discussed a lot in the council meetings elsewhere. The UN has a practice of convening donor pledging conferences. Maybe this could be the case in the case of Ukraine.
Possibly. Yes, let me see. That's a good, valid point. Richard.
It's summer, but this question symbolically has some weight to it, though it doesn't compare to some of the other topics. And people say the UN is behind the times. I can't remember how long it's been, but when thousands walk into the UN lobby, the clock on the wall is an hour behind or completely off. And maybe we discussed this months ago. I can't remember. And maybe it's officially broken. But
which clock?
The on the wall.
In the visitors'
near
lobby?
The elevators. Yeah, no, in the secretariat lobby.
Okay. Well, and let me see what the if I can move the clock even further back.
Time stands still here, but not that bad.
Yes, I know. At least hopefully the year's right. Evelyn, then Matthew.
On Ethiopia, Eritrea, the UN, is there a peacekeeping force envisioned? Or any details? Because the UN has
No, the UN was present in Ethiopia, Eritrea for a long time. The mission closed.
I remember.
We were also involved in the Border Commission. As I said, we're willing to help the parties as much as possible. Matthew, then Linda.
Is there anything planned?
No, as I said, we're looking forward to hearing more details.
Matthew, go ahead. Okay, I wanted to ask you this. It has to do with Cameroon. It's reported that, and it's reported, it's identified Samuel Eto'o, the football player, as a UN goodwill ambassador, and it's said that he will be touring with government officials, the Anglophone areas, trying to encourage people to either go back to school or stop protesting. And so there's a lot of pushback against it, and I wanted to know, one, when's the last time Mr. Fall was in the area? Maybe you have it or could find it.
There's nothing more than what is publicly known.
Is this number? Would Samuel Eto'o's trip, if it takes place, he's in Yaoundé, would it be as a UN goodwill ambassador?
And I have to check what his status is and who he actually
is. What people are saying is that he said nothing about this crisis the whole time.
No, I'm not debating it. I just have to see what the details.
I'd appreciate an answer on it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Linda.
Thank you, Steph. I believe there was a meeting last evening between the Secretary General and various Arab and other ambassadors, and I was wondering if you could share some information.
No, there's no read. I was on the broad Middle East situation, but nothing to share.
What about the meeting with the Africa group today? Is that about budget issues?
No,
is it about personnel?
I'll try to get some details. Thank you. Brendan, all yours.
That was the spokesperson for the UN Secretary General, Stefan Dujarric, at the UN headquarters on Thursday, doing his daily press briefing. On Thursday, Russia's President Vladimir Putin held a marathon four-hour teleconference with constituents from around the Russian Federation and members of the assembled press and various government agencies. RT's Murad Gazdiev has more.
Well, it's difficult to sum up 4 hours and 20 minutes of questions and answers, but some of the things that really stood out was what Vladimir Putin had to say about foreign affairs. And here, for example, Vladimir Putin recently presented a slew of super weapons. We're talking here about bigger, more powerful, faster nuclear missiles, ballistic missiles, as well as hypersonic missiles, which travel at 6-7 kilometers a second through the atmosphere, about nuclear-powered missiles. And one viewer challenged Vladimir Putin, saying, you know, does this stuff really exist?
There are those who doubt new Russian weapons are soon going to be put into service. Back in 2004, they were doubting the avant-garde system. But now we see it in Syria. And that's not everything that we're planning to produce and put into service. As I said in my address, it's too early to talk about it, but we will speak out soon.
The president stressed that this isn't about saber-rattling or waving your guns around or, measuring anything with anyone, but this is about parity. This is about making sure that Russia has a deterrent, that no enemy, no potential opponent can overcome Russia. And here, another particularly worried viewer asked Vladimir Putin how close we are to World War III.
You know, you can recall Einstein's words. He said, I don't know with what weapons World War III will be fought, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. The understanding of the fact that World War III may be the end of modern civilization must deter us from extreme actions on the international scene.
All this war talk and fears is no surprise given current tensions between the East and the West, between Russia and the United States and its allies. And people ask, when is this going to end? When is this division going to end, these sanctions, these restrictions? And Vladimir Putin said that they won't until we all treat each other as equals, until nations learn to respect each other and to compromise, to understand that there are differences and various countries have various interests. He pointed out Europe, where he says the winds are changing. There is now open talk of lifting sanctions against Russia. Vladimir Putin stressed that, sanctions and restrictions, they've never served anyone. They always come back to bite whoever put them in place. And he pointed to the trade war that has just erupted between Europe and the United States, saying that the new tariffs that Washington has slapped on the Europeans, which have made them very unhappy, those aren't so much tariffs as they are sanctions.
One of the French government's ministers recently said that the U.S. shouldn't be allowed to become the economic policeman of the world, and he spoke about it publicly. The former German minister of finance publicly said that Germany hasn't been a fully sovereign state since 1945. Everybody can see what's going on, but probably our partners thought it would never affect them. That kind of politics is counterproductive, a politics of limitations and sanctions.
Now, that was what Vladimir Putin had to say about foreign policy. Obviously, most of what was talked about in this Q&A session was domestic affairs, domestic things, things that worry Russians, such as salary, taxes, healthcare, education, corruption, always a big one. But Vladimir Putin also spoke about the upcoming World Cup, due to kick off in about a week in all over Russia, really. And he said that the Russian team lately hasn't played as well, perhaps, as some would expect. And he said he hoped that now that the World Cup is here, they'll really show what they've got.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The transatlantic relationship has had many ups and downs since its inception after the Second World War. It is said this relationship has weathered these moments of tensions and differences due to American leadership. Enter Donald Trump. Can the transatlantic relationship survive the current occupant in the White House? Crosstalking the transatlantic relationship, I'm joined by my guest, Michael Maloof in Washington. He is a former senior security policy analyst in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. In London, we have Indrajit Palmar. He is a professor of international politics at City University, London. And in Oxford, we cross to Mark Allman. He is the director of the Crisis Research Institute. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let me go to Mark first in Oxford on Skype. You know, Mark, these last few programs, I keep betraying my age. Well, I can remember a good part of the history of the transatlantic relationship. And there have been ups and downs. There have been policy differences. We can think of Vietnam. We can think of the illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq. During the Reagan administration, it was intermediate missiles. And they've pretty much been resolved. Those were problems. I get the impression now that it's turning into divisions about values and the position of each in the world, because the Europeans, after all these decades, have pretty much, you know, tied themselves to the United States and have very limited options, and they're not very happy about it. Is this a crisis of ideology and values now, not just policy issues? Mark in Oxford.
Well, I think it's a mixture of, it's a crisis of values where there's a big disagreement about what is important and what should be principles between Berlin and Paris on the one side and Washington on the other, shall we say. But it's also about valuables. In many ways, the Atlantic Alliance from the late 40s onwards was one in which the United States was prepared to pay an economic price for security and geopolitical advantage. And so the Marshall Plan and onwards meant that there were certain trade imbalances that revived the European, West European economies. And initially at the expense of the United States, but overall everybody benefited. Now Trump is saying it has to be a cost-benefit analysis on a day-to-day basis, and putting America first means America has to come out on top. And that, of course, is causing serious problems to European industries, European finance in general, because suddenly the United States is throwing spanners in the works in all sorts of directions, pulling out of the Iran deal, sanctions on Russia and so on, which have a big effect. And then also Trump articulates a view of the world which the European elites, and to a great extent the European media, regards with abhorrence, to be quite frank. And so there's a problem. And then there's a problem even with the British as the closest ally to the United States. They find themselves challenged economically and also challenged to some extent on what is publicly acceptable here. And Trump, of course, hasn't helped by tweeting about things in Britain that have gone against the grain of British public opinion.
If I can stay with the British Isles here, on the very top of this, we have the Iran deal that the U.S. withdrew from. But it seems to me that that is an archetype of the problems of the transatlantic relationship right now, because the Europeans are being told that they have to pay an economic price when they're staying in the deal and Iran wants to stay in the deal, too. I mean, it seems a bit large on the part of the United States saying, well, since we don't want to be part of it, you shouldn't be part of it. And this gets down to really kind of sovereignty, at least EU sovereignty. I'd like to talk a little bit about energy as well. But, I mean, the Europeans are being asked to go against their best interests in almost every single way. And this is causing a great deal of tension. Go ahead in London.
I think, you've summarized the position in some respects, but I do not think that there is a kind of fundamental breach. I think the Europeans are clearly unhappy. The one major diplomatic success, if you like, they can claim was the Iran nuclear agreement, and they're very upset at the United States' withdrawal from it. But on the other hand, their ideas about Iran and Iran's regional power and its ballistic missile testing, they don't differ very much. So I think they would appear to be a big tactical difference here. And so what I would argue is that at the core of transatlantic relations, from the very beginning, I don't think there was ever any altruism involved. There was always a position of power and a negotiation about power and power distribution. So I think what the situation is now is that it's changed. And to some extent, there's a renegotiation of those relationships. And I don't think it's only the United States which is acting much more towards its particular national interests. European powers among themselves have always had a tension between the European element and their national interests. So I think this is just being exacerbated at this particular time. And clearly Donald Trump plays a particular game. But I think in the end, the levels of interdependence between the European Union, Europe and the United States remain very, very high. And I think there is a bit of upset here. But I don't think there's a fundamental breach.
Well, we'll see here.
There are many tensions which have lasted a long time.
Let me go to Michael in Washington. I mean, interdependency, I think there's a lot more dependency than interdependency, and that's what we're seeing right now. And I guess fundamentally, can we have a transatlantic alliance, coalition, as it were? Can it coexist with America First and Donald Trump? Michael.
Well, it's beginning to erode. What we're seeing is an erosion and perhaps a replacement of the U.S.-led unilateral world order. And I think that the breaking out or leaving the Iranian deal, the JCPOA, was a watershed moment for countries in Eurasia and especially Iran, as well as in Western Europe. And what we're seeing emerge now is a new geopolitical shift to a much more multipolar approach. And we're already seeing this, just like what you probably saw in St. Petersburg with the Belt and Road Initiative, combined with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the Eurasia European Union, all beginning to come together with its membership, forming this separate economic world order bloc that's actually going to counter and respond to what Donald Trump has now done. I think Europe as well, because of the sanctions, are going to rebel to as much as they can, and we're going to see that they're going to want to maintain that trade with Iran as well as with the other countries in that region of the world. The whole idea, because the United States insists upon having the Israeli policy interfere with every foreign policy decision it makes, yeah. it's actually beginning to shift away from that, and we're seeing that already.
You know, Mark, it seems that there's a perception, I've heard this many times, that the United States is treating its friends worse than its enemies. I mean, it's essentially going down a track of threatening to sanction European countries and their companies. And this is getting, I think it's the first time in the Transatlantic Alliance experience where, sovereignty really seems to is being infringed upon. I mean, threatening companies, there's financial transactions, it's forcing companies to start trading in other currencies so the U.S. Treasury Department can't go after you. I mean, is that what NATO allies are supposed to be worried about from the United States now? I mean, this is a new dilemma that this coalition, this alliance is facing. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I can show my age by saying I do remember when even Mrs. Thatcher had a falling out with Ronald Reagan over the U.S. attempt to prevent the export of then Soviet gas to Western Europe and yep. to prevent British companies taking part in that. So there have been precedents. The point is that in those cases, quite quickly, the common interest overrode the divisions and they found a way out of it. Whereas today, we face the prospect, I think, that Donald Trump could, he's only going to almost certainly be in office for the remainder of this term, he could be re-elected. And if he continues with these policies, he's really challenging the European sense of self-esteem in the one area where they feel like a great power. Yes, the EU is a geopolitical pygmy, is a military pygmy, but it is a trading superpower. Germany alone, after all, exports more than the United States imports, and that's a lot of exports. So Germany and China, for instance, and also, say, countries like Japan, have an economic common interest in the wider world, which Trump is trying to unsettle because, of course, he wants to cut back dramatically the U.S. trade deficit. But that actually means hitting, to a great extent, his key partners, as well as a potential geopolitical rival like China. So we really have structural changes taking place. Maybe all these decades of cooperation, all the cultural contacts between West and the United States and the broader West will somehow tend to mitigate this. But I have a feeling that in the end, it'll be dollars and cents that count.
Yeah. Interjet, let me go back to you in London. I mean, right before Trump withdrew from the Iran deal, we had Boris Johnson visiting. We had Emmanuel Macron visiting Trump as well. And I think that they were expecting some kind of negotiation like allies and friends are supposed to do. And they returned home empty handed. In the meantime, Angela Merkel has visited Putin twice and gone to China. She didn't even go to Washington. There's a perception, at least on this side of the pond, is that the United States isn't interested in negotiations. It's more interested in diktat. Do it or else. Go ahead in London.
Well, actually, Angela Merkel did go to Washington, D.C. and meet Donald Trump prior
well
to
before.
The
right.
withdrawal, yes. Along with Macron, for example, just after Macron, and was given a slightly different kind of treatment. I think there's a very complicated question, and I think to some extent there's a kind of broad long-term shift going on in the kind of global geopolitics and geoeconomics, and I think then there are these kind of tactical transactionalisms which Trump is championing, and I think to some extent Trump is being criticized, but in the end, he's standing up for what he believes is the American national interest.
And he's keeping his promises. Let's keep that in mind. It shouldn't be surprising, yes. Okay? He said this on the campaign trail. Keep going.
Yes. And I think what I would say about that to you is that I think a large part of this is really a sort of tactical power play. And it's as much directed at home, at his political base, to try to show them that he is standing up for the United States. The key thing that he had promised, really, that America First was going to do for them was to basically give them back economic and other hope. And I don't think actually any of this is going to help that core base at all. So in the end, effectively, it's a big theater. And I think the levels, the amounts of money we're talking about here in regard to the kind of sanctions on trade or trade tariffs or whatever is relatively small. It could lead to more. But I think in the end, I don't think this is a massive shift.
And trade wars usually start small here. Gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the transatlantic relationship. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
All right, I'm going to go back to Michael in Washington. One of the interesting questions that have risen that isn't given much coverage is the energy politics and energy security that includes the UK, the rest of Europe, the United States, and interestingly and importantly, Russia here. And Germany is very much in the center of it with the Nord Stream pipeline, the second one that's going to be is being built. And the Americans are profusely against this pipeline because they want to import or export to Europe very expensive LNG. And the Germans are resisting it, and they could face sanctions. As we talk, announcements could be made. This is a very important issue because Germany and the European Union are actually de facto being denied the ability to determine their energy security. It's the U.S. wants to dictate that. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, it has to do with Russian dominance of it, and that's the problem. And the U.S., as you point out, is a Johnny-come-lately to this in wanting to ship LNG or liquefied natural gas. But the problem for the United States is it only has one port in Louisiana that can export it. And secondly, most of the European countries, except those along the coast, have any LNG capabilities. The countries that really, really need this kind of gas are much more internally, and certainly Germany as well. But the pipeline structures that exist right now and are being built with Russian dominance, if you will, is what's irritating the neocons here in Washington and certainly the Trump administration. So it's a Johnny-come-lately effort, and I don't think it's going to succeed. And they need natural gas now because winter is not all that far away, and they have to have a reliable source. And you're going to see more and more of these countries integrating themselves apart from the United States because of this activity. And energy is just one aspect of that whole geopolitical shift that we're seeing emerge at this point.
You know, let me go back to Oxford. Mark, again, it gets down to being able to make sovereign decisions. I mean, I don't think you have to be very ideological or very partisan to question, well, why should a country that's on the other side of the planet determine your energy policy when you have a neighbor that wants to provide energy at a reasonable price and your companies are involved in a joint venture to build that pipeline? I mean, I don't see how threatening that possibly could be, except for you want the market. You want the market share. I get that. That's fine. Okay. But it should be the Europeans that ultimately make that decision. Mark in Oxford.
Well, obviously, to some extent, also, the United States would like to weaken Russia's position by weakening the state revenue by cutting its exports of energy. But as the Austrian president, van der Bellen, said, the great problem is that LNG is only economically viable when energy prices are high. And actually, because you negotiate long-term contracts with Russia to receive gas, you get the gas well below the price at which LNG is viable. So you have this, it is what I suppose our Marxist friends would call a dialectical contradiction. In order to make LNG viable, you have to create a high revenue stream for Russia, which makes Russia stronger and makes it more fearful to the West. But if you try to, and if you also have bad relations with Iran, pull out of the Iran deal, you push up energy prices. So actually you make the position of these countries that you are hostile to or suspicious of stronger. And also you make their ability to offer rebates to customers more attractive. So it actually is not a very clever policy, it seems to me. It's not going to achieve what it's intended to.
Okay, Inderjit, let me go back. Let's change gears here. I'd like to talk a little bit about NATO. Ever since the end, the advent of the Cold War and the Warsaw Pact, we've had NATO. When the Soviet Union came to an end, NATO decided to stick around and look for a new mission for itself. Unfortunately, in 2018, I guess that mission is to defend against Russia. But the European countries don't really want to pay for their defense. They kind of like having the U.S. pick up the tab. Trump says you got to pay more, and they still don't do it. So it's kind of hard to convince publics that Russia is such a threat if you don't want to pay for your own defense. Except for Poland wants to spend $2 billion to have American troops there. Well, why don't they just give the $2 billion to the Germans, and the Germans can do it for them, okay? I mean, there's a lot of possibilities there, okay? Again, countries that want to have secure borders, particularly vis-a-vis Russia, they don't want to pay for it. So how do you square the circle there? Go ahead, in London.
Well, I think in Germany, actually, there are quite strong pressures from various sides of the political spectrum to strengthen German military power and also its kind of much more independent stance on a number of global questions. So I don't think there is an unwillingness on the part of many of the European powers of NATO to increase military spending to 2%, which is what they're actually committed to under
There's a lot of resistance to reach that 2% of GDP. I mean, they've been talking about it for years, and they're still not doing it. Okay, what? Only four countries out of the entire bloc actually do that. Okay, I mean, they still resist doing it. So that doesn't cut water with me. No, they want something for free, and then if they don't get it for free, they don't want to pay for it. That's how, Michael, you worked at the Defense Department.
Yeah. Well, I see that the emphasis is more on economic betterment between Europe and Russia, because that is they have a major dependency there. But the whole military concept has basically evaporated in favor of more economic opportunities, such as in dealing with Iran, dealing with China, dealing with Russia. I mean, it's expanding, and NATO, as you pointed out, is still an entity trying to find a new mission, and they went to Afghanistan for a little while. They're still there, but you know, it's on life support, frankly, and the Europeans for itself is looking internally to have its own defense mechanism, and the French are pushing that pretty much, and I think the Germans, because of what Trump has been doing and the way he's been bludgeoning them, I think they're beginning to re-examine that concept, but they don't see the threat that the neocons and Trump do from Russia, from China, or from Iran, as Trump does.
Okay, Inderjit, let me go back to you in London, because you didn't get to really finish your point there. I mean, do you think that there is the political will? I mean, the European Union, for all of its problems, is one of the richest places on the planet. I mean, it's not like it doesn't have resources. It has plenty of resources. Unfortunately, a lot of them are wasted, but they still are relatively rich. Why shouldn't they just, you know, step up and really, if they're complaining about the United States and Trump, why don't they just go it alone? Like, it's not as if they don't have the resources to do it. Go ahead.
Well, I think going it alone is probably unviable for any major power or bloc today. That interdependence which has built up is very, very dense. The networks, which are financial, economic, political, security, intelligence, as well as people-to-people ideas, in every respect, you look at the interdependencies of major global pillars. They are very, very great. They're not going anywhere. You can try to shake them up. You can rearrange them a little bit. You can renegotiate relations. And I think that's what Trump is trying to do, and some other powers are trying to do as well. But I don't think you're going to get rid of that. I don't think Europe wants to or can go alone. Britain is finding itself. Look at the position we're in now, negotiating a Brexit deal. Look how difficult it is to try to do anything meaningful with that. Because in the end, you cannot just divorce yourself from a global economy and so on. What you can do is try to create a sort of national conditions under which you can control the effects of globalism. And I think that is what is effectively happening on a worldwide scale, because the people of the countries within, like the United States and elsewhere as well, they're suffering from the effects of inequality. They're suffering from the fact there's unemployment because of technological change and innovation. And I think people like Donald Trump are effectively misleading their own electorates by calling for America first. And I don't think they're going to solve any of those problems. But in the end, that is where the pressure is really coming from. And I think that is not going to go away. And that is going to lead to a degree of national level of control. So I think there's going to be a renegotiation of the kind of global compact, which allows for local control a bit more.
It's pretty pessimistic what you just said, because it sounds like all these organizations are straitjackets. You're in it and you can't get out. And there's one hegemon that will determine the rules. I mean, that's essentially what you're saying. I think that there is a political will and division. I think that there could be much more multi-polarity. I think there could be a lot more equality in it. But I don't see the political will. The Europeans can moan and groan all they want, but they're fat and happy with the situation the way it is. And Trump is, and the U.S. is going to be able to snipe at them, and they won't be able to do much about it. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I think also there is a problem when we're talking about the Europeans. Who do we mean? There is the networked elites of people who are involved in government and so on, who are very comfortable with the old order, and in a sense they're unhappy about Trump shaking it up, but also they can't imagine leaving it. But then we've seen, whether it's the Brexit vote, the Italian election, even the Austrian elections and so on, a huge popular unrest, including in Germany, with all sorts of aspects we've been hearing about of the downsides of globalization. That's why Trump, after all, won presidency in the United States. So I think there is a crisis of the West, and in a way, it's something which the elites in the EU and NATO don't really notice. It struck me that NATO has just held its first meeting in its new purpose-built headquarters, and the only law of sociology that I respect is Cecil Parkinson's law, that any organization that moves into a brand new purpose-built headquarters will go bust within 18 months. And one fears that we have this kind of institutional inertia that can't really imagine that the architecture that's been built up over the previous decades is seeing its foundations sapped away by the very popular consent, which, after all, was the basis of a democratic alliance.
Okay, Michael in Washington, last 40 seconds of the program goes to you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is that the erosion of that unilateral world order, and it's beginning to catch up reality is beginning to catch up to the Europeans, just like with Theresa May. She's doing Brexit, of course. She looked to the U.S. as an alternative market, but because of sanctions, now she's going to be looking more and more toward China. And I think you're going to see that wave increasing in the coming years, simply because we have this new multipolar emerging that is going to just isolate the U.S. unless it stops its batting people over the head all the time.
Well, we'll see. We'll see if America First can coexist with the transatlantic alliance that has existed since the Second World War. Seems pretty incompatible to me, but we'll see. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, London, and in Oxford. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio. .org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.